speaker for today will be introduced by Monica Ramirez. Ms. Ramirez is the Research Translation Coordinator for the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program and has experience moving information and technology from researchers into the hands of decision makers at all levels. Some of her activities include building linkages and partnerships with U.S. and Mexican government agencies, creating innovative bilingual communication tools, and conducting informal learning experiences for people of all ages. She has an MPA in Environmental Science and Policy from Columbia University. Monica?
Thank you, Justin. So as Justin stated, the overall goal of our Research Translation Corps is to actively communicate the research products generated by our Superfund research program to pertinent audiences and stakeholders in the most appropriate and effective manner. To improve these efforts, there is a short survey at the end of the seminar entitled Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institutions and Remediation Stakeholders. So it would be greatly appreciated if you could complete the survey. Only about 7 questions, and the results will definitely be put to good use. The EPA Superfund Research Program Seminar Series is the result of an ongoing collaboration efforts between the EPA Region 9 Superfund and Technology Liaison Mike Gill and myself. After discussing and delineating the scientific needs of the regional project managers and the research strengths of the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program, Mike Gill and I designed an information transfer series that has 2 parts. The first is called Live at Region 9, and that is where a U of A or Superfund research program investigator presents at Region 9 headquarters to a live audience face-to-face with project managers within that region. And the second part is the Internet seminar, which you are about to hear, that incorporates input from the live presentation and allows us to reach a larger audience. So due to its great success, Mike Gill and I have continued and grown this seminar series, so we're in our 3rd year. And I'm happy to introduce Dr. Wendell Ela. Professor Wendell Ela received his MS and PhD from Stanford University and joined the faculty in Chemical and Environmental Engineering at the University of Arizona in 1998. He has been a principal investigator for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences Superfund Research Program projects for about 10 years and has particular interest in understanding the post-disposal behavior and impacts of residues from water treatment technologies. He currently has research groups working on assessment and improved management of arsenic-bearing water treatment residuals, enhanced water recovery and benign concentrate disposal for inland, portable water desalination, measurement, impact assessment, and treatment of persistent organic contaminants. And he's additionally involved in the development of metrics, technologies, and strategies that facilitate preventative environmental engineering. Recently, in August of 2009, Dr. Ela was the co-chair and organizer of a specialty workshop sponsored by NIEHS entitled Superfund Contaminants, The Next Generation, which brought together a select group of interdisciplinary experts to develop a roadmap for how NIEHS Superfund Research Program might avoid the creation of another generation of Superfund hazardous waste sites. His teaching focuses on water and wastewater treatment processes and advanced water remediation engineering and remedial process feasibility for hazardous waste site cleanup. So I'm happy to introduce and honored to be working with Dr. Wenda Ela.
Thank you, Monica, and thank you, Justin. We should be on slide 3 right now is where I'm starting. And to give you a little bit of background as well as motivation for what's yet to come, let me walk through this slide. The topic today is really trying to get ahead of what is coming down the pipe in terms of contaminants specific to Superfund sites and hazardous waste sites in general. So it's not the whole contaminants of emerging concern area, but a subset thereof of those contaminants that would be of interest as creating the future Superfund sites or the future hazardous waste sites. And that's really the focus of today's talk. This focus was the motivation for a workshop, as Monica said, last year in August, where at the University of Arizona we assembled a group of experts to essentially talk about how do we identify the contaminants that are most likely to create the next generation of Superfund sites, and then hopefully, how do we prevent them creating it? In other words, how do we circumvent that generation process? So what we're really interested in is trying to move into a more proactive rather than remediative stance in terms of Superfund contaminants and Superfund foci. The idea here was, obviously, you'd like to be able to identify the specific contaminants of concern. In other words, come up with a list and say A, B, C, and D are the ones we should be talking about, the rest we don't have to worry about. That's probably a little naive to think that we would get to that point, or even that that point is foreseeably reachable in the future. What also has to happen is one has to look at what are the tools we have and to measure the contaminants of emerging concern, what are the judgments that need to be made to delineate those that are particularly of hazardous waste site relevance, and then utilize those to create a continuously evolving list of the specific contaminants of concern. And that's where we're headed, and that's in today's talk, and that really was the foci for this workshop that occurred in August. So what I'm going to talk about is the an outcome of that workshop and the follow-on work since then. Going to slide number 4, this is a slide showing the participants in that workshop, and I want to very much give the credit to this, to these people. I'm really a spokesperson for this as opposed to an originator of most of these ideas, that these people on this list were the participants in the workshop, and they're the real expertise and brains for what's gone on to date with respect to what I'll be presenting today. The list or the column on the left side of the screen is the organizing committee. The other columns include the other participants, and those with the red asterisks, I've actually used slides they presented at the workshop directly in this presentation, so I want to give them particular credit for the work they've done and the input they have on this presentation. Going to slide number 5, the question one we put in front of ourselves at the start of the workshop and at the start of the presentation today is, how do we define those emerging contaminants or contaminants of emerging concern that are going to create the next generation of Superfund sites? So first of all, obviously, you have to define, well, what qualifies as a Superfund site. The generic, if you look up on the web and the definition that's provided there, is somewhat enlightening, but perhaps a little general, in that it specifies that they're uncontrolled or abandoned places where hazardous waste is located that may affect local ecosystems and people. Now, that certainly brings to bear this idea that it's a hazardous waste. There has to be some risk involved with respect to that waste. And it likely has to have some exposure route to a target that would be harmed by virtue of that waste being present. So to go a little deeper into that, try to get a little more specificity, you can look at the hazardous ranking system by which you quantitatively define a score that then is determinant for whether or not a particular site goes on the Superfund list, the NPL list. That gives a little more idea of what we're looking at, which brings to bear this idea that the characteristics of the waste have to come into play here. One has to think about the toxicity of the waste. One has to think about, is there sufficient quantity of that waste present where it would create a hazard because of its presence, even though it may be very toxic. If there's a minimal amount there, then the quantity is a determinant. And lastly, are there sensitive targets somewhere proximate to where this waste is either being disposed or accumulating? And those are essentially the attributes at the front end that one has to think about. Moving to slide 6, if you look at the plethora of chemicals that we use in commerce today, you're initially quite daunted by the task ahead if one thinks about identifying those contaminants of emerging concern. There's a ballpark number somewhere around 90,000 chemicals in commerce now in North America. Of those 90,000 chemicals, there's about 12,000 that are registered as pharmaceuticals or pesticides. And why I point those out is those are a little better characterized than the rest on it. And I say a little better because it's certainly not that they're well characterized in most cases on it. Of those chemicals, there's about 275 compounds that now appear on the CERCLA priority list. So much less than 1% of the chemicals that are in commerce appear on the CERCLA list. Now, that's not surprising. Most chemicals are not hazardous and don't present a particularly significance in terms of hazardous waste site dynamics. But the other piece that is more concern is that of most of these chemicals, the 90,000 chemicals out there, we really don't have any data as to whether or not they should be contaminants of emerging concern or contaminants specifically of hazardous waste site concern. Going from that, then, there's just this sense that there's a probability that there are probably a lot of chemicals out there that are of hazardous waste site relevance that, as of yet, we really haven't identified, and we may well be generating these future hazardous waste sites unbeknownst to us, simply by virtue of our ignorance of the properties and the accumulation effects and other practical implications of having this many chemicals of unknown characteristics in production. Going to slide number 7, the first order of business then to narrow down this very large set of chemicals that we have in commerce, to try to narrow down to those that are of this hazardous waste site relevance. That was the first task that the workshop tried to grapple with. And there is some precedent out there, very good work that a number of different researchers in different countries have done. The first piece of business is to say, well, how do you characterize a contaminant of concern specific to hazardous waste sites? And what I'm showing here is really the bottom line, or what came out after a lot of discussion and a lot of thinking since then, of the characteristics that one would look at among those 90,000 chemicals and say, if it has these characteristics, then it has a high likelihood of being of concern to hazardous waste site generation. The first is point here is the high production volume. Now, that's really a surrogate parameter, because it's not specifically the production volume that determines its relevance. It's really the specific use that determines the relevance, and that you have a large volume that would have a likelihood of accumulating or being disposed in a common place. That's really what you're after, but there's no data for that sort of accumulation. And so the next best thing that we can perhaps go to in terms of databases and readily available information is, what is the production volume of a chemical? And by relationship, then, if it is a high production volume chemical, it has more likelihood of having high volume where it accumulates or where it is disposed of. The second piece that is relevant is that the chemical would probably need to be persistent. In other words, chemicals that readily break down in the environment or don't persist for reasonable periods of time probably are not going to create hazardous waste sites. So even though a chemical may be a very high production volume, may be very toxic, it probably won't generate a hazardous waste site if it doesn't persist over a reasonable period of time. Now, persistence initially opens a little bit of a can of worms, because persistence is defined by the environmental contaminant in which you're interested. So persistence in groundwater can be quite different than persistence in, say, a surface water, where you have photo destructive effects and that sort of thing. So within this persistence, one also has to consider the environmental compartment of interest. The third bullet is bioavailability. Even though a contaminant may be there in a large quantity, may be persistent, if it's not bioavailable, it's probably not going to create the exposure and the hazard that we're interested in. So one has to take into account something in terms of bioavailability, bioaccumulation, that sort of idea. Obviously, then, even if the organism picks up the contaminant that's bioavailable, it has to be toxic. There are a lot of contaminants that go through our system with very little toxicity associated with them, or at least at this point we know of very little toxicity. So you also have to add on the characteristic of toxicity. Now this is from a somewhat self-serving point of view, you usually think of as human toxicity. But also it has to include the whole ecosystem, because we're part of a greater whole here, and the functioning of the ecosystem is certainly relevant in our long-term sustainability. So that toxicity is both in terms of human as well as other biotic systems. Lastly, the idea here that really says, is this contaminant of emerging concern hazardous waste site relevant, rather than just relevant from a generic human exposure perspective or ecological exposure perspective, is does it accumulate sufficiently to create this hazardous waste site idea? We have a lot of chemicals that one might point to. Let me give you an example. For instance, disinfectant byproducts in drinking water that certainly are generated to reasonably high masses, if one thinks about all the drinking water systems and the mass that might be generated. Yet those chemicals tend to be in very dispersed, they don't tend to accumulate, so it's unlikely that most of those disinfectant byproducts would be of hazardous waste site concern. And so there's this last bullet really delineates the hazardous waste site relevant chemicals from the greater universe of all contaminants of interest. Going to slide number 8, the task then is really knowing these attributes that we're really homing in on. How do we get from where we are right now with what we know to where we need to be to really prevent hazardous waste sites or future Superfund sites, if you will? As I noted here, the attributes of interest, and this is somewhat of a recapitulation of the attributes that I talked about on the previous slide, we can go down through those somewhat sequentially to try to narrow and narrow and further narrow the field to come up with the final list of those of interest. The issue, the way I've listed these here, is really they're listed in terms of the knowledge we have of that present attribute. And as you work down through the list, you get less and less knowledge. We need more and more work done on them to be able to step down through that list. The other piece, then, that I don't want to leave until the end, I want to up front make sure it's clear, is that there's a lot of luck in this whole enterprise. And there's a dependence on human curiosity. We certainly don't have all the questions right now in front of us that we need to be asked. And we certainly don't have all the attributes or specific characteristics of chemicals in front of us to say if it's got this or that functional group, or it has this or that type of behavior in the environment, then automatically that says it's in as opposed to out or vice versa. So there has to be this element of curiosity also, and serendipity in the sense that, as most sportsmen know, that good luck is a lot better than good play, that this also applies to emerging contaminants, of being able to identify those of particular interest and coming up with a relevant list at the end. That all brings us to the point that this whole enterprise depends on a real ongoing evolutionary type of evaluation, where we have brain trusts of people working in very different fields coming together to keep putting together the whole picture of what are those of contaminants of most relevance, and letting that list or that small set of contaminants continuously evolve as our knowledge evolves, as our analytic capabilities evolve, as our ability to further winnow the field evolves. Going to slide number 9, a lot of work on talking about production volume has already been done, or at least a good start on it. I don't want to imply that we're anywhere near closure on this. But there has been some very good work, and it's illustrated by the work of Derek Murr and Phil Howard, that they've published a number of papers on, where they're their approach has been to say, let's look at the chemicals out there in high production volume, medium production volume chemicals in the databases that are available, and from that then try to narrow down looking at persistence and bioaccumulation or bioaccumulative likelihood, try to winnow down that very large set to a smaller, more tractable set to then subsequently look at from other perspectives on it. So what you're starting with really is this very large set of chemicals that I show in the pie chart here that includes pharmaceuticals and cosmetics, pesticides. Let me say the pesticides are probably the best understood now of the chemical groups in terms of their persistence, bioaccumulability, toxicity, characteristics in terms of structure and environmental behavior. When you look at pharmaceuticals and cosmetics, we have a little less knowledge. And then when you jump down to the Tosca and the Canadian equivalent list as Tosca, you have this very large set that we have very little knowledge of. So there's that 42,000 there. We also have this very large group of polymers, and they're it's a group that really hasn't been addressed yet in terms of emerging contaminants. So it's probably the least tackled group at this point. Even within this large pie that I show, there's not included a lot of the chemicals that are out there in use. There's the minor use chemicals. We don't include in this the degradation products, byproducts, isomers, chemicals that would be in imported products as opposed to the products that are in the European, Canadian, and American or U.S. databases. So this is not what's shown here all-inclusive. It's a first cut, though, on a place to start that perhaps gives us a handle on some of the most or the major chemicals that might be of interest. Going to slide 10, once one has production volume, and once at least one tries to define a universe based on production volume, then the next thing you need to do is try to put into that this persistence of bioaccumulation. In other words, of those chemicals that have medium or high production volume, which are persistent and which are also bioaccumulative or have a likelihood to bioaccumulate. And this is what Muir and Howard have done, as well as other researchers have been looking at, is say, let's develop the list of known high production volume, medium production volume chemicals for which there are these attributes known. We'll pick those out. For those HPV and MPV chemicals where we don't know those attributes of persistence and bioaccumulation or don't have metrics that we can gauge that by, then we need to use quantitative structure property relationships or some other model to estimate what the persistence and bioaccumulation might be relative to that. Put those chemicals then into our list that fit those criteria. And then lastly, because the QSPRs are not sufficiently well developed for certain groups of chemicals, just really don't have enough data on them to develop QSPRs, you have to also use a lot of scientific judgment, which really comes down to expert subjectivity, to look at the additional chemicals and identify those chemicals that aren't grabbed in the first two pieces and add those into the subset. And then at that point, come up with at least a first cut on saying these chemicals are the ones we perhaps should now take further to look at toxicity, ecotoxicity, likelihood of accumulation, that sort of thing. So going to slide 11, if one does that, and this is what Muir and Howard have done on it, is they initially looked at what was out there in the readily available databases from Europe, from Canada, from the United States on it for the medium and high production volume chemicals. And when they looked at those that had bioaccumulation factors greater than 1,000, they had judging persistence in terms of atmospheric oxidation and air water partitioning coefficients, they were able to come up with 105 chemicals that were identified. And they used the EPA-suite EPA software to come up with these 105 out of that large group of HPV, MPV chemicals. At that point, then, they went to this last step where you take expert judgment and looked at bioaccumulation, biomagnification, potential persistence, potential, and came up then, going back into those additional chemicals with the expert judgment, and added another 505 chemicals onto that list of the 105 for which they had the better data or the more quantifiable data on it. So what they were able to do was then come up with a total of 610 chemicals that out of the much larger set of about 22,000 chemicals that were initially screened. If you go to then slide number 12, you can look at the types of chemicals that really make up that set of 610. And it's quite illuminating in a lot of ways. If you think about the halogenated chemicals here, they make up about, not quite, but almost two-thirds of all the chemicals in that 610. So it immediately says if you're looking at the chemicals out there of interest, really the halogens are kind of the biggest hit group. The chlorinated, particularly the fluorinated compounds, about 30%, so almost a third are fluorinated compounds, organics. Then the brominated as well. Then you have a group of the siloxanes, which is something we really don't have much data on, but they certainly pop up as very relevant on it. And then there's this group of non-halogenated compounds that make up a large fraction of those compounds. Going to slide number 13, again, I want to try to go along here and keep giving the disclaimers if I can as we move through this. Because this is a process in infancy to a large degree to doing what we're doing. And I think the start and the information here is excellent and really puts us on a good track. But it's certainly not exhaustive by any means in terms of the issues to be dealt with and the chemicals to be dealt with out there. And so what this slide is talking about is the things that really are probably have fallen through the screen or fallen through the cracks by this approach. And so it's done a good job of giving us a small subset, but it hasn't included things like degradation and transformation byproducts really aren't fully assessed in this approach on it. As I mentioned before, imported products are not captured in it. If they're within imported items, but they're not the chemical of particular concern there. There's a real issue in terms of going to what I'll go to next, which is toxicity. At this point, there's no toxicity used in this prioritization, or very little toxicity information used in this prioritization. That's certainly a big issue, because chemicals that may be of lesser production volume, maybe slightly lesser persistence or lesser bioaccumulation, but are highly toxic, maybe are being incorrectly discarded at this point. So this is not to say even of those chemicals that are looked at that all have been included necessarily properly. There's also the PMB screening hasn't been done. Persistence and bioaccumulative screening has not been done for this whole group of polymers, for a lot of the impurities in that. So there's a large group of chemicals out there that haven't been looked at all. Going to slide number 14, this really gets now to the next piece. Once one comes up with those that have a high production volume or high use on it, one has some idea of those that are persistent, those that are bioaccumulative, then one really has to deal with this very difficult topic of toxicology. And as I say, as I move through this, we're really getting from our best known or best understood attributes to lesser and lesser understood. And so when one gets to toxicology, you really start understanding or realizing the limitations of our understanding now about these emerging contaminants and how do we winnow the list further to those of particular interest. If one looks at computational toxicology, which is really the tool we have to try to bring this level of hazard closer into perspective in terms of human toxicology, particularly, one has a lot of tools that are all modeling tools or in silico, most of these tools, including the computational chemistry tools, molecular biology tools. Those are the omics, as we talk about a lot nowadays. Computational biology tools, which get up to a larger organization in terms of biotic organization. And then right up at the top of the list here, these systems biology, where one tries to put it into population dynamics and those sorts of things. And we do have tools in all of these areas, but I don't want to suggest that those tools at this point are really probably up to dealing with the task at hand. We're a long ways down the road, but there's a very much longer road still to cover on it. And so each of these areas, there needs to be work done, but equally importantly, the work has to be integrated into a whole so it fits into this bigger picture of how do we use that knowledge in any of these niche areas to educate and further focus our list of these amine contaminants of concern. Going to slide 15, let me try to put this in a little more perspective of the toxicological models we're interested in. And one way of looking at this, and this is thanks to Eric Weber at EPA, a slide that he's developed in an idea and a concept that he elucidated at the workshop, was that one really is trying to work from the source of the, or in other words, that contaminant that we've identified or that chemical we've identified of interest, over to the point where one comes up with some outcome or effect of that particular contaminant. Now, it's not a simple single jump here. One actually has to jump through a number of steps to make that transition from what we have that we're putting out in the environment to what effect that has from a toxicological perspective on it. And so one goes through, as this slide indicates, through environmental fate and transport models. You have to get you up to some environmental concentration. You have to go through exposure models to go from the environmental concentration to what is the external dose proximate to some organism. One then has to use pharmacokinetic models to go from that environmental dose to what is the actual uptake of a particular tissue or a particular organ on it. So that's the pharmacokinetic models fit in there. Then you're going to need metabolic models to go from the dose at the organ or tissue of interest to what is then the metabolic effect of that, what is the outcome at a biological level. And finally, once one has that, then you have to say, well, that's at an individual level. How do we now move that up into a system at some population level or some greater level? And so we have to have system models. And so there's models that need to be developed at each one of these linkages. And when we look at what's out there right now, we really have a pretty good start on the environmental fate and transport model, certainly not perfect, that I'll mention later. But as we move progressively from that source over to that outcome term, the models become tougher and tougher to apply to the task at hand. In other words, we have more and more to do to make them applicable. So going to slide 16, let me give one example of a type of model here in the time we have. And this is using metabolomics and specifically using spectroscopic methods, NMR in this case, to look at once you have an exposure of a particular chemical to a particular tissue, how do we look at that metabolic response to that exposure? And so what is done in this particular study is being shown is there's an NMR spectra of urine samples from mice, but these mice were exposed individually to different toxins that have particular tissue-specific action. And then you look at the NMR spectra, and what you see as you march down through it is one can see that as the exposure for different toxins, you get a different NMR response in the urine, which is an easily sampleable quantity or an easily sampleable entity in terms of the mice, as opposed to having to go directly to each individual organ and come up with that toxicity from every tissue type or each organ type within the organism. And so it indicates a very powerful approach that certainly is something that the type of approach that is very relevant and very necessary to be able to march through and get up to an outcome from that source term. And then in the list that I won't go through, what one can see these attributes that suggest that the attractiveness of this type of approach. Going then to slide 17, we really now jump into something that's really tough now, because we're really moving now from human toxicity. Most of the what I showed before is really looking at certainly mammalian, if not human, toxicity. When we want to now look at ecotoxicity, and this is probably the bigger challenge again, where we have the least amount of precedents developed and have the biggest challenges in front of us. So it's not to say that there's not excellent work going on out there, but it's probably the area where we really have to put a lot more directed emphasis and a lot more directed support if we're going to succeed in this challenge in front of us of identifying these contaminants of emerging concern from waste site relevant. What I'm showing here, and it's this is credit to Deb Swackhammer, who presented this at the workshop, is that if one looks at any of these different types of chemicals or these chemicals of emerging concern, whether they be hormones or industrial chemicals, musk, fragrances, pharmaceuticals, pesticides, so on, that their potential routes of impact go through a whole suite of different possible systems, biotic systems. And so one can't just say, let's look at estrogenic responses, and that will sufficiently categorize whether a particular pharmaceutical is of interest or not of interest. We also have to look at androgenic responses, anti-androgenic responses, thyroidal responses, the whole suite of different possible systems that will determine different, certainly, endpoints, physiological endpoints, but nonetheless relevant endpoints. So it's not quite as simple as just a black and white, if you have A, then we look for C outcome, and we're done with it. When we go to an ecological perspective, you want to have to consider all the possible physiological or biotic outcomes to be able to really determine some overall ecotoxicity. And that is an enormous challenge, and we really have just started this in a lot of ways. Going to slide 18. One example of this is if one looks at the endocrine system or hormonal system, to illustrate the complexity and the challenge here, is that there are a very large number of steps if one's going from a hormone production where a hormone is secreted into the biotic system to the point where we actually have a metabolic outcome. So in this case, we talk about the steps being, and I've simplified the steps here significantly, or at least Deb has simplified them significantly, in that the glands secrete the hormone then has to bind to some relevant receptor, say a human estrogen receptor, in the case shown here. That in turn up or down regulates genes. The genes in turn create the transcription, which with the mRNA, that in turn creates the protein production, which finally then you have that metabolic outcome that we're talking about. Now the issue here is that a compound can affect any one of these steps in the process and consequently create this toxic effect. And so one can't just look at particular steps or this, as I say, black and white, A leads to B, because different compounds affect different points in this sequence of events that have to happen before you have a metabolic outcome on it. What this does then is it means that different chemicals act at different points, and they will act, the same chemical can act at different points at different concentrations. So we get things like nonlinear responses and responses that certainly don't follow what we historically look at as a dose response curve. So going to slide number 19, This is really just a certainly not an exhaustive laundry list, but trying to give some representative ideas of what these confounding issues are that come out of this sort of ecotoxicological perspective on it. And again, I don't want to walk through these one by one, but put this up more to give an idea of a representative number of issues that one has to deal with if you're really going to succeed in quantifying the ecotoxicological effect of different emerging contaminants, or any contaminant effect. It's certainly not purely two eco contaminants, emerging contaminants. But let me point out a couple of them, because I haven't touched on them yet. And that is that there are different points in life cycles that contaminants can act on. And for instance, we're all probably aware of, say, lead toxicity, its relevance to children as opposed to adults. And we really worry much more if early in the life cycle lead exposure compared to later lead exposure. Same thing with this whole realm of greater contaminants that we're interested in. So we can't just look at one point in an organism's development. We have to look at all points through that life cycle and then the toxicity relevant to all those points. We also have to look at transgenerational effects, because some of these, if they're acting on germ cell or gen cell production, then the effect may not be in the exposed by organism, but it may be in the next generation organism, which further confounds the issue or further challenges us in terms of our ability to really cope with whether it's ecotoxicological effects on it. So going to slide 20 then, trying to look at this in a similar way to the way that we looked at the metabolic cascade, but a slightly different perspective, that one also has these levels of biological organization, and one has different tools to look at the impact at different levels. And from an ecological point of view, it's really at the population level is where you're interested in terms of ecological effects. Does the system as a whole become significantly affected? But in terms of our ability to understand effects, it's really down at the molecular level that we have our best diagnostic tools, that we have our best understanding. Now, not to say that that's a perfect understanding by any means, but on a relative scale, we know more as we go backwards down the level of biological organization to the smaller and smaller levels, and i.e. the molecular cellular levels on it. And so what this suggests is, number one, that we need to work a lot on these higher level biological organization models, these ability to understand how those molecular and cellular level impact whole tissues, impact individuals, and finally impact ecosystems in general or populations in general before we'll really be able to close this circle. And we haven't done very well at making those links between the different levels of biological organization. So there's a real need there to make the links where we have some very good bioassays, but we really can't link those to physiological responses, or we can't link those to whole organism responses and then to population responses. And until we make those linkages as well as the tests with each particular level of organization, we're really not going to be able to succeed in this endeavor. So going to slide 21, let me touch on that point that I emphasized initially, and that is this importance of serendipity and curiosity. And obviously this is something I can't really say this is the way we generate good luck or this is the way we generate curiosity. All I can say is it's important. An example that illustrates what I'm trying to talk about here might be looking at the Aerojet Superfund site in Sacramento, California, and thanks to David Sedlak for this slide and his discussion of this particular problem on it. This is a Superfund site that was chlorinated solvents, was originally looked at as being not completely cleaned up, but certainly good job done at cleaning it up. That was through the 1980s. Then as analytic methods improved, and there was the subsequent monitoring of that site, it was recognized that there was a NDMA there, which was not initially identified as a contaminant of interest there, but it was there in very high concentrations, and subsequently have had to go back now and start looking at that site again from an NDMA perspective, even though the chlorinated solvents, to some degree, were taken care of. So this idea that we have to still be curious, we have to keep reevaluating, keep evolving with time as our analytic methods, as our understanding of what's relevant improves and evolves. Going to slide 22, this, again, is just the same idea, that we have to be cognizant of the evidence that we have out there. A lot of times there's the evidence we need to drive us forwards that we don't always see. This is often seen from analytic chemists' perspective by the unknown peaks they get in chromatographs that they may see as they do routine monitoring or monitoring for different substances. An illustration is with the chlorine plus, which was actually picked up in samples during routine monitoring in the Great Lakes area. And it was just as an unexplained peak, but kept seeing these peaks no matter what, at different sites that were being evaluated in different environmental compartments. So looking at seeing these peaks in air, seeing it in sediment, seeing it in water. And saying, you know, we should probably look at what those peaks are and recognize them, that there was this highly chlorinated organic contaminant that nobody had really been thinking about that was pervasive through those ecological compartments on it. And so we need that sort of curiosity, which is part luck, but certainly has to have a lot of intellectual curiosity to keep on top of these contaminants of emerging concern on it. Let me go to slide 23 then. The other way we can perhaps narrow the field down is by saying, well, where are these contaminants likely to accumulate? Because this really gets back to that last bullet earlier on, noted that we were really interested in those contaminants that have a likelihood of being disposed in quantity or accumulating in quantity at points where then they would create these hazardous waste sites. So it's not enough that they just be persistent, bioaccumulative, toxic, but they need this accumulation or this concentration effect as well on it. So one might think, well, where are the likely sites that these contaminants of interest are going to accumulate? And the, again, thanks to David Sedlak for this slide and this thought on it, that if one thinks about the brominated and the fluorinated flame retardants that are very, very widely used now, we tend to think of those as being pretty dispersed because they're really in all our fabrics, they're in a lot of our electronics, plastics, those sort of things, which are dispersed throughout the environment. But if one then thinks a little further and says, well, there are some places, though, that those are used in quantity in very localized situations. And so then the study that David brought up here, Schultz et al., they looked at where there is a training center for firefighters where they use these flame retardants regularly. And that essentially now, those have accumulated at that site. So we get this now hazardous waste site potential of high accumulation at a particular site. And so it takes this sort of innovative curiosity for a lot of these contaminants, because we may think of them initially as being very dispersed and not accumulating, whereas in reality there are these sites where they probably are accumulating and may be producing this hazardous waste site potential on it. So just one illustration of it that I think is really a nice illustration. Going to slide 24, let me come back out to this general idea of serendipity and curiosity, and that is that these bullets try to just bring together the conclusions out of that. We need to keep developing new tools, and we then need to look at those tools to identify these mystery peaks, these unknown contaminants. but it puts a particular onus on analytic chemistry and analytic chemists to both better continue improving our tools we have available, but then also utilize them in this environmentally or emerging contaminant realm to broaden our understanding on it. Going to slide 25. So out of the workshop and out of this, what I've talked about before, there are a large number of research gaps identified, and I perhaps have even overemphasized what we don't know at this point. But what it suggests is to move forward, we need to have a sustained and coherent, and I emphasize coherent, effort here to close those research gaps, and particularly in high priority areas, so as to really have an ability to be more proactive in terms of these contaminants. And what I'm listing here are some of the areas that the workshop participants identified as key areas in this particular or this challenge that we have ahead. They include things like looking at the end-of-life fate of contaminants of emerging CERN. In other words, once they're disposed, it oftentimes is a byproduct or the transformation product for the real problem. And so if it has accumulated a contaminant at some site, do we have the ability to understand what that transformation products and that are? And the answer was no, we really don't use it. So that's a real research gap. Just grabbing another couple of examples here, we have to really look at unconventional responses and impacts of these chemicals. We can't use the traditional dose response models and the traditional endpoints as the catch-all for toxicity. So we need to expand that universe of endpoints, expand that universe of modes of action to be able to address the challenge in front of us. Likewise, we need to utilize the opportunities that we can identify now, i.e. there are some potential areas that we think might be potential areas of accumulation. We need to, for those areas, now concentrate some effort at doing epidemiologically and environment or ecologically relevant studies in those areas or at those sites and say, are there biological responses that are being seen in those particular areas? Are there particular chemicals we see persisting that might explain those biological responses? So there's opportunities here that one can, it's not just a fishing trip in the broad universe. There's certainly ways of homing down where we should look and how we should look. Going to slide 26 then, these are some of those sites that one might look at if one is to say, let's pick out the highest likelihood sites that we might say would be the next generation of Superfund sites. Now, I don't want to say this is exhaustive again, but just these are representative of the sort of places one might look. So, for instance, landfills and landfill leachate disposal sites, something near and dear to my heart locally, which is a lot of these chemicals, they may be broadly dispersed, but then we reaccumulate them in landfills. And so we need to look at these landfills and the leachates in terms of these emerging contaminants as much as we look in terms of the traditional contaminants. And so on through these other sites, both new and traditional sites on it. Going to slide number 27, these are some of the recommendations that came out, and these are fairly broad, but I think are indicative of some of the real areas we need to focus on. First of all, is that there is a unanimous agreement that we need to expand the Superfund and the hazardous waste site focus to include these other emerging contaminants, or these contaminants that we really don't look at now when we look at the priority list for CERCLA. That there is a large number of them out there, a very large number are likely going to be key actors later on, and we can't ignore them if we want to really be proactive and spend a dollar now to save literally thousands of dollars later on it. That list has to be evolving. We don't have the knowledge yet to be experts in defining what are the contaminants of interest, and so we need to have a very dynamic ability to create this list and keep updating this list as we learn more and as new instruments and technologies, tools evolve. Talked about the attributes that are of particular interest. If there's a strong feeling, if it's not persistent, it doesn't have points of accumulation, it's not toxic, then really we can probably take it off the list for the time being on it. Whereas bioaccumulation production volumes are indicators of interest, but are certainly not as self-limiting in terms of being on the list of contaminants. We need to increase this list by using algorithms, expert judgment, curiosity, serendipity. And lastly, we can't use the all of the historic metrics of success to say, are we succeeding now? Because typically we look at success as being how much of a particular contaminant have removed from a hazardous waste site, and that is a metric of whether or not we're succeeding now. What we're really talking about is avoiding having waste sites. So it's avoiding having the accumulation. And so it's almost a hypothetical game in success now of saying it would have accumulated had we not done such and such. And so we need to take into the realm of success or the realm of quantifying success these hypothetical accumulations. In other words, challenges or negative outcomes avoided has to be also considered when we talk about success in this. Going to slide 28 is really up to you at this point. I'd like to hear from you if questions, thoughts, comments.
Thank you, Dr. Ela. Real quick, before we go to the question and answer session, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the links page, the survey, and the online feedback form. On the links page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. Links to the additional resources page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide, slide 29 of the presentation. Also on the last slide of the presentation is a survey developed by the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program titled Improving Collaborations Among Academic Institutions and Remediation Stakeholders. Please take a moment to fill out the survey. I will now open the question and answer session. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute, state your name and organization, and ask your question. Also, if you have been using the mute button on your phone, in order to ask a question, you will also have to use *6 to unmute your phone. So we will go to the phone lines first. Go ahead, unmute your phone and state your name, organization, and ask your question. Okay, while the phone participants gather their thoughts, we have a question here from one of the simulcast participants. The question is, referring back to slide 9, would the potential for illegal drug lab contamination to generate Superfund sites be part of the pharmaceutical pie?
It's a good question, and this actually came up in the workshop a little bit. It really depends on is the compound or the chemical covered under the current drug. Is it a production drug that's covered by FDA? If it is something that is covered by FDA, then it would be one that would be covered in these chemicals. Now, that's not to say that all illicit drugs are FDA-approved drugs that would be under the pharmaceuticals, cosmetics, that sort of thing. So the answer is both yes and no, that some are included in that number, but there are many that would not be included in that number. So it's really whether it's a chemical that's now federally regulated as a pharmaceutical or drug.
Great, thank you. I neglected to mention that question was by Curtis Payton of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Sacramento, California. The next question is from Jim Cowart of Enviro Group Limited in Centennial, Colorado. The question is, how does this effect relate to POPS, CCR, and EU lists and efforts?
Okay, let me stay on slide 9, when Muir and Howard, and I'll use them as an example because I think they probably have done a lot of the real algorithm development for this. They, in developing their list of the 22,000, 23,000 chemicals that were evaluated, they looked at the DSL list from Canada, the TSCA inventory from the United States. They looked at the European database. And so they accessed all those databases to come up with that initial list of the high production, medium production chemicals of interest. And so it does include those chemicals that are on those lists. And they went through those lists and then threw out duplicates and so forth. But it does include that universe, not the whole universe, but that universe of chemicals of interest. So I hope that's what you're asking, but it did include a reasonably broad set of databases, and those databases are right now one has confidence in and are readily accessible in terms of identifying the high and medium production volume chemicals of interest.
Great, thank you. Before we proceed with any simulcast questions, let's try the phone lines again. If you have a question, please take your phone off mute by pressing *6, state your name, organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Okay, we'll stick with the online participants. This next question is from Frank Volkering in the Netherlands. The question is, how do you cope with synergistic effects?
that's a great question, and it really comes down to those toxicological responses where we need to move from the individual chemical molecular response to the mixture higher order responses. In other words, how do we take a number one look at the effects in mixtures as opposed to single contaminant issues, and there's no question that those are very real concerns, and we see that manifested often, that the response to a mixture as opposed to a response to the individual chemicals within that mixture, we get a very different response in the mixture than we do by some additivity or other function of the individual chemical responses. We also see that if going from, say, a bioassay, which is amenable to exposure to a mixture on it, we have a very hard time then going backwards from, say, a bioassay response to a analytic chemical response. So we can analyze the chemicals within the mixture, say, the quantity of each. Then we look at the bioassay response to that same mixture. We have a very hard time coming up with appropriate models. Certainly we know additivity doesn't work, or certain potency-weighted additivity doesn't work very well. But there's a necessity to cross that boundary, because very seldom do we see these chemicals in isolation. They're always in some environmental matrix, and very often with other chemicals of concern. So I think your question about synergy and your question about, which implies this idea of mixtures and that, is very real. And that's one of the big research areas that was identified over and over in the workshop, of our necessity to grapple with that, not only from hazardous waste site chemical perspective, but emerging contaminants in general perspective.
Great, thank you. Let's try the phone lines once again. If you have a question and you're on the phone line, please press *6, unmute your phone, and go ahead and state your name, organization, and ask your question. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and unmute all the phone line participants just in case there's a problem unmuting their phones. They're unusually quiet. So if this causes any problems, which, you know, we don't know what's going to happen, really, I will mute the phones again. So here
all participants have been unmuted.
Okay, now if you're on the phone lines and you have a question, go ahead and ask your question.
This is Gordon Williams with Struckle Technologies. Can you hear me?
Yes, Gordon.
Yes, we can. Go ahead, Gordon.
Thanks. I'm in Oakland, California. My question is, do you think there should be required toxicological testing for chemicals before they're put on the market, or for some sort of process for all these new chemicals as they come about, to be thinking about them before they get used?
That's a good question. It probably comes really down to a pragmatic response of how practical is it. If one were to put the same rigor or stringency on testing that we put on, say, pharmaceuticals or human use chemicals, then it's probably completely impractical. You realize how long it takes to, and the number of tests that have to be undergone before a pharmaceutical goes from development to actual human use or open use on the market. So that level of testing is probably impractical when we think there's literally thousands of new chemicals coming on the market every year. There's some 7,000 or so chemicals on average that are being added every year. So we'd be swamped. We'd be underwater to do that sort of thing. That's not to say, though, that there shouldn't be some sort of screening, perhaps, for new chemicals as they come on. The sort of screening that I'm implying here is things like if we can identify relevant bioassays that might be utilized to just give an initial scoping response to chemicals, not with a particular endpoint in mind, but to say, does this seem to elicit a negative or a potentially hazardous response on it? So I think there's some middle ground there between the full stringency of a human use chemical and essentially just letting things come on the market with no concern at all for potential toxic effects. I'm certainly not an expert in that area, so I'm not one to suggest how close we are to having the appropriate assays or bioassays that might serve as scoping tools there, but I think it's something that one should potentially consider. And if we want to really go down this path very far, something we'll have to consider doing.
Great, thank you. We can stick with the phone line, see if there's anyone else who has a question. Okay, moving right back over to the online participants. This question is from Celia Chin, Dartmouth College. The question is, what do you suggest should be done about the inadequacy of endpoints such as standard toxicity testing for contaminants such as nanomaterials? How would you suggest that the endpoints be expanded?
it's to the point of one of the slides is that we have a whole list of different endpoints that are certainly ecologically relevant and more specifically even just from a human physiological response relevant. And there's no master list out there of what are all the endpoints that should be considered. So in response to your question, I agree that our present scope is perhaps inadequate, or we need to emphasize looking at other endpoints with the same sort of interest and rigor that we look at the traditional endpoints, to say cancer, that sort of thing. But at the same time, we have to be judicious. That one cannot try to put your arms around the whole world of possible endpoints and expect to get to a practical ability to deal with the highest probability contaminants quickly. So we have to also try to come up with the particularly relevant endpoints that maybe are indicative of other endpoints. So they're indicator endpoints, if one can put it that way. Otherwise, we end up on essentially too many possibilities. The matrix of parameter space becomes too large to feasibly handle. And so there needs to be this, what I talked about as being a brain trust, or this thoughtful reflection and say, well, what at least at our present state of knowledge would be a representative surrogate group of endpoints that might give us the best chance of corralling the highest probability chemicals right now. Not all of them, but the highest probability ones. So it's going to require some judicious expertise here to come up with a list that's relevant, not all-encompassing, but useful at the same time, or practically feasible to implement.
Great. This next question is from Hugh Thompson of HTA Science and Engineering in Fair Oaks, California. Question is, the Aerojet NDMA finding was suspect due to knowledge of the Rocky Mountain Arsenal finding associated with storing UDMH. Ammonium perchlorate toxicity after 1980 did not offer a warning of hazards that were eventually recognized after 1990. How in the system proposed would perchlorate have been identified as a potential problem?
You're absolutely right. In fact, you emphasize the point, which is that at the time when this site was first characterized and the contaminants of interest were identified, we couldn't identify at that time, or we wouldn't identify with the tools we had available and the way we did things at that time, the NDMA and the perchlorate. So I don't mean to suggest that there were mistakes made at that time. It's more that I'm trying to suggest that as we develop new technologies, new instruments, specifically in this case, instrumental analytic capabilities, we have to revisit sometimes those places that we have already looked at as being coped with, or at least under control. Because these new analytic techniques and these new algorithms that can become available open up a bigger universe of chemicals of interest and chemicals that we can usefully put into our repertoire now than was previously envisaged. And so you're quite right that it's not an issue of blame that something was done wrong initially. It's more a realization that we need to keep evolving, and we need to re-look at areas that perhaps we've already gone over, as well as look at new areas.
Okay, this next question is from George Murniak with Army Public Health Command in Aberdeen, Maryland. The question is, are there agreed upon criteria for defining PBT?
No. I mean, there, even in the broader spectrum, there are not agreed upon criteria for essentially any of this. There is no standardized set of attributes or quantifiable metrics that can be applied to any of these groups of chemicals or these types of production volumes on it. So, and that is part of the challenge. And the broad areas that I elucidated, the persistence, the bioaccumulation, the toxicity, those are the broad areas that have to be considered. But within those, one cannot go down and say, well, if it has a bioaccumulation factor greater than 500, automatically it's on the list as opposed to being off the list or something like that. We're not at that stage, will we ever, I think, be at the stage of saying there are going to be these hard and fast cutoffs. All of these are indicators, and so it's more the weight of the total evidence as opposed to any particular single parameter that one can look at and say that defines this chemical as on the list as opposed to off the list. It's really taking the weight of all those parameters, the quantification of all those parameters, and saying something like the hazardous, when we put a chemical on the NPL list, we look at a number of different characteristics. We add up a quantitative score, and it's the sum of that quantitative score that matters rather than in any particular aspect the individual score. The same idea in terms of metrics for these chemicals.
Okay, this next question is more of a question to the whole group. I will read it, and you're welcome to comment on it, or we can move on to the next one. This is again from Hugh Thompson at HTA Science and Engineering in Fair Oaks, California. The question is the group aware that very similar efforts were undertaken by the UN specialized agencies after or around 1973 to list and understand chemical hazards to the marine environment as published by GSAMP that drew upon experts and data worldwide?
I'm not intimately familiar with that work, but I am aware of that work, yes. And I've been remiss in not in the examples I've used here. These are examples. These are not trying to say this is the only work that's been done in this area, nor was the workshop that was convened here the only workshop. There is certainly a very explicit acknowledgement that there are a lot of people doing excellent work here. There have been a lot of conferences and workshops on emerging contaminants. What's been shown here should be looked at as representative or examples of the work that's going on and the studies and the databases that have been created, but not either the pinnacle of those nor all-encompassing of those. And so your point is well taken, that we do need to do more of what I'm talking about, but we also need to look at what already has been done, and there have been a lot of good studies that need to be linked together to come up with a better overall sense, because very often we tend to work in our silos and reinvent wheels, and that is obviously very counterproductive, and so we don't do a good job of looking outward to what other people have done and how does it apply to what we're doing and how do we link it with what we're doing. So I think your point is excellent in that we do need to essentially have an effort to put together all the data that we do have out there as much as we have to generate more data.
Okay, let's check the phone lines again. Are there any phone line participants who would like to ask a question? If so, please press *6 to unmute your phone, state your name, organization, and go ahead and ask your question. Okay, we still have several from the online participants we'll try to get through. This next question is a question and then kind of an example and another question, so I'll go ahead and read it in its entirety, and then if you would like me to, I can read it in part. So the question is, has there been any additional consideration on how to assess contaminants for which there is very little toxicity information once they are detected in the environment? We have a site where groundwater has been impacted by sulfalane. We know that it is persistent in groundwater. It's used in industry, although not widely, nor in high production, but there is very little toxicity data. It might not have been considered based on the evaluation criteria presented. Is there a way to fast-track assessments once contaminants have been detected, and is there a complete human exposure pathway available?
Okay. Yeah, I'm not familiar with the particular contaminant or the structure or that you're talking about, which is maybe exactly your point. But no, there's no set tool that one can say, let's always apply this and this gives us the answer in terms of toxicity or environmental relevance, ecological relevance. But I think one of the research gaps that I identified, and one of the things or tools that we have not perhaps sufficiently used and linked to other outcomes is this use of bioassays. Now, bioassays have been used, they've been largely used in the endocrine disruption investigations as the first tool, because that was really what was where the endpoints were first seen, is through biological responses as opposed to single contaminant identification. So I think they are probably the best screening tool we have now, the bioassays, but there's not a single bioassay that one can point to and say that's the best one to use, because they go to different endpoints, they deal with different organisms or tissue types on it. And so it's not that one can, as I say, point to a single screening tool that we have available. But in answer to the best advice I can give in answer to your question is, one would want to look at it in terms of some of the bioassays that are available there, some of the look at it in terms of some of the models that are used in terms of metabolic responses that were talked about it with Eric Weber's work in those slides. And I think that gets one at least at a first cut, and a reasonable idea perhaps of whether this contaminant or this particular chemical is of interest. One can also look at just the, there are ecological structure activity relationships out there, ECOSAR being one of those models that one can utilize and get an idea. That it's not going to be that you're not going to get false positives and false negatives with those tools, but at least it gives, it's not that we're without any possible ways of addressing what you're asking.
Great, thank you. We are nearing the end of time, and we still have several questions, so I'm going to try to get, or we'll try to get through as many as we can. This next question refers to slide 7, the last bullet. Question is, can you explain one more time?
The last bullet? Okay. Because the interest in this particular workshop and in what I'm talking about today is not just to the contaminants of emerging concern, but it's specific to those contaminants of emerging concern that have a high likelihood of creating the next generation of Superfund sites or hazardous waste sites in general, Superfund being a little U.S.-centric. So the last bullet is really the idea that one, if you identify a contaminant that has high volume, toxic, persistent, bioaccumulative, that's not in and of itself sufficient. It also has to have this likelihood that it's going to accumulate or be disposed at a single point or at a relatively spatially concentrated point, so it would create what we consider as being a hazardous waste site or a Superfund site. And so certain chemicals are likely to occur where they'll accumulate or be disposed where they'll accumulate. Other chemicals are not as likely for that to occur. So things like the example I use of say, disinfectant byproducts in drinking water, those are probably not likely to accumulate because the drinking water is used in a very dispersed fashion. Those contaminants, even though they're certainly toxic, persistent, a lot of those, they're probably not going to be disposed or accumulate at some point source where you'll come up with a hazardous waste site designation. Now, this is not to say that they're not of importance. I don't want to give that impression. It's really just to say that within the scope of the mandate for this particular work and this particular thought process, they're outside that scope.
Great, thank you. This next question is from William Bertie of DuPont Company in Newark, Delaware. The question is, Was there any discussion in the August meeting on emerging pollutants other than chemicals, such as genetically modified organisms? Slide 26 may be interpreted as including them as potential emerging pollutants.
It came up a couple of times. Organisms, say genetically modified, as you say, organisms. An analogy is, it came up, we talked a lot about nanomaterials. Now you'll notice I didn't really talk about that. Some of those, if you will, categories of contaminants, were really looked at as saying at this point we don't have enough specificity within that category to try to put them into this rubric that we're developing. Now that may be a fallacy of the rubric itself, I mean, or an inadequacy, a weakness of the rubric. But to some degree, when I think about nanomaterials, it's also a function of that we really haven't categorized down to say, well, which nanomaterials are of particular interest. If something is simply a nanomaterial, that's probably not sufficient to say that should now go through this same set of discussions just by virtue of being a nanomaterial. It doesn't throw it on the list automatically. The same I'd go with genetically modified organisms or that sort of thing. That one needs to look at that category of contaminants, I'll call it quote unquote, and try to then be able to define characteristics within that that then make it likely to fit to the attributes that we're talking about here. And it was not by virtue of saying they shouldn't be included, but more by virtue of I don't really know how to include them at this stage, that they don't show up on the list. But you're right. They should be included, those ones that are of interest. It's just we don't really have the tools to sort them out very well right now.
Great, thank you. We have time for one more question, and then we will have to conclude. If you do have additional questions, you can contact Dr. Ela via email. If you submitted online questions that we did not have time to get to, I will forward those to him. This last question, I believe you have already at least partially answered. However, the asker does mention a specific chemical, so I'll go ahead and ask it. Are nanochemicals such as silver being examined in this process?
We talked about them, and we actually had a couple of experts that we specifically invited to the meeting who are experts in nanomaterials, both from a impacts or human and ecological impacts perspective as well as a perspective of production and the engineering side of it. I don't remember well enough if it specifically came up, but I know that a number of the metal catalysts, I remember palladium, platinum were talked about, silver being a biocide that is often used now, and those were explicitly talked about in the idea that they probably are something that should be included, but at this stage we don't really have enough data on their use, their volume of production, their how they're essentially being incorporated into commerce, and so we have a very hard time of saying, are they going to potentially accumulate in places? Are they going to reach concentrations that are going to be of biological interest? In other words, is the environmental concentration going to reach at hot spots a hazardous level on it? And so again, it's in terms of silver nanoparticles, they're certainly very much in the news and are something that we need to consider those sort of things. They're exactly the sort of emerging contaminants we need to consider. They were not specifically put on the contaminants that were highlighted here, for instance, in the Muir and Howard list. They weren't considered there. But that's not because they were omitted by dint of saying they don't shouldn't be on the list. It was more by dint of saying we really right now don't have enough of the tools to say which should and which should not be put on the list. On it, so they're I guess, on the table right now and under observation would be the best way of putting it.
Okay, thank you very much. Once again, I would like to thank Monica Ramirez for organizing this presentation and, of course, our presenter, Dr. Wendell Ila. And one more reminder to please fill out the online feedback form and the online survey. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you, everyone, for your participation.